Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Betsy Stark in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. His job is to tackle life's sticky wickets and thorny questions, the everyday ethical quandaries we all encounter. Randy Cohen started his career writing jokes, but today he writes the Ethicist column for the New York Times. This hour on Point, parsing life's moral challenges, large and small, with Randy Cohen from the New York Times. You can join the conversation. Do you need some advice about a sticky situation? What's your question for Randy Cohen? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now is Randy Cohen. He writes the Ethicist advice column for the New York Times Magazine. He's written for The New Yorker, Slate, Harper's, and also for Late Night with David Letterman. He's the author of The Good, the Bad, and the Difference, How to Tell Right from Wrong in Everyday Situations, and his new play about an 18th century Jewish bare-knuckle boxer called The Punishing Blow opens this Friday in New York. Randy Cohen, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Betsy. You're a big fight fan, are you? You like the bare-knuckle boxing.
I tell you, it's quite a bio. Let's jump right into this. One of the questions we teased in telling our listeners what to expect today was this one. Can I bring my own snacks to the movies when the theater says no outside food allowed? Can I?
That was the first question I got flamboyantly wrong since writing the column. When I went back and retracted my initial foolishness. My first position was no, you couldn't. That when you bought a ticket, you knew the rules, you agreed to obey them. And after all, it's possible to go 2 hours without eating. I believe Protestants do that routinely in church. There's no snack bars there. I myself am Jewish, so I'm not sure. But I think I was wrong about that. And the readers persuaded me that when you buy a movie ticket, what you've agreed to do is see a movie. That's it, and not disturb your neighbors. If the theater wants you to buy a 10-gallon tub of popcorn, you know, for $200, I think that's the current price, they should offer food you want at a price you can afford. So you'd be violating a rule by doing that, but I don't think you'd be behaving unethically.
That's interesting that you changed your mind. Do you change your mind? It's a fairly rare occurrence, right?
Oh, I wish it were rare. I wish that were so. Once you put your email address at the bottom of your column, you hear from the readers very quickly. And since the column is only 600 words and I take up two questions, I often feel my job is to oversimplify. And the readers are very quick to point out where I've neglected a part of an argument or missed part of a situation or, what's that ugly word, wrong. I was just wrong. And they can be quite persuasive. So about once a year, once every 18 months, I go back and revisit a question that I've just bungled and take another pass at.
Well, it makes me wonder, though, how much of ethics then is situational, not a matter of black and white, right and wrong, but circumstances. I mean, for example, stealing is against the law, but is it okay to steal food when your baby's hungry and you don't have any money?
Nearly every moral philosopher in all of human history would agree that you can steal to avoid starvation. That's not an unusual position. I'd be hesitant to dismiss that as situational. But I do agree that these are certainly questions about which honorable people may differ. But it doesn't follow that every argument is equally good. And my task often is to make a reasoned case why the behavior I prescribe is the right behavior.
And I imagine that you're often being asked questions by people who are rationalizing things themselves. I mean, is it okay to water the tomato plants when there's a local ordinance against watering the yard? I'm going to use those tomatoes to feed my family.
Oh, that's right. And I'm working on my life-saving serum that will save millions of people based on my tomato recipes. Yes, we all have an incredible capacity to rationalize whatever is in our own interests. It was Ben Franklin who said how wonderful a thing it is to be a reasonable creature because we can always find or make a reason for anything we care to do.
How did you end up becoming the arbiter of such things?
Oh, arbiter is too fancy a title for me. It turns out I have no authority. I can't actually make you do anything I advocate. The column was an in-house idea at the New York Times Magazine. The editors conceived it and then invited a bunch of people to audition for this job. And when I say a bunch, I hope you'll picture, oh, I don't know, 100. So my triumph will be all the more glorious. But I think it was closer to half a dozen or a dozen. And they gave us all 3 sample questions, very much like what runs in the column. And it was just enormously fun to work out the answers. They're like intriguing little puzzles. But I never thought I'd get the job. And having gotten it, I didn't think it would last as long as it has. And I'm enormously grateful for both things. I love my work.
Is there a method to how you arrive at your answers? Do you rely on any regular advisors? Do you consult the Bible?
I take a resolutely secular approach to the column, both to the column and in my life. I'm a secular person. I was raised, as I say, in a Jewish household, but I haven't been in a synagogue since my own bar mitzvah, except for other people's celebration. So, no, I'm quite secular about this. Here's what I've come to think. I feel doing a job like mine, you become more and more self-aware about what your methods are. I think for me and for many people, well, this is not my observation. This is someone else's. But an analogy was made between an aesthetic response, you know, to a painting or a piece of music, and a moral response. That when you see a painting, you don't have to think, what do I think? You know, you immediately respond to it. Or when you hear a piece of music, you don't have to go, oh, I hate that. You don't reason your way to that. You simply respond to that. But that's the beginning of the process. Afterwards, you start working out, well, why did I feel that way? And is there another way to approach this? And I think that's true not just in your aesthetic responses, but in our moral responses, that when asked a question, you know, should I water these tomato plants? Your question, even though there's a community-wide rule against it, I might initially think, oh, sure, what the heck? But then I have to start applying moral reasoning to criticize my own conclusion and determine if I've come to the right conclusion.
And when you're really stumped, you call Mom?
I do call Mom. There are a series of kind of tools for moral thinking that I use. They're the ones many people use. The golden rule is one. Kant's idea that you should act as if you're reasoning for everyone. If I can do it, then, well, what would it be like if everyone did it? These are great tools to help you examine a moral situation. But if they all let you down, yeah, it's not so bad to call your mom. I think that saying, well, I still embody the values of the family and the community in which I was raised. And the person who can articulate those most clearly is my mother.
Well, I'm sure mothers all over are going to be glad to hear you describe it that way. Let's get to one of the ethical dilemmas posed by a listener. Bill is calling from Reading, Massachusetts. Bill, welcome to On Point. What's your question for Randy?
Well, I think it's an ethical dilemma that in our society we try to answer the problem of drug addiction and drug abuse with the use of police forces and jails and prisons and things like that. And it seems to me like these people have a problem, and throwing them in jail is not helping them with their problem. And I think that's an ethical dilemma.
Thank you, Bill. Randy, is it an ethical misstep to put a drug addict in jail rather than in treatment?
We've entered the zone where matters of public policy overlap matters of ethics, and it's an obscure zone, and one my editors tell me to steer clear of. But I absolutely share your listeners' conclusion that to criminalize drug addiction is utterly the wrong approach as a matter of public policy. But here's where I think ethics kicks in. If you – an honorable person might think, well, we should try a criminal justice approach to this problem. But once you've tried it for decade after decade and it's flamboyantly failed, that it's destroyed the lives of thousands of people, it's clogged our courts, it's imprisoned millions of people, particularly the poor and the African American, that to persist in a failed policy as a public official, that I think is unethical.
Do you find over the years that that there are trends or themes that emerge on ethical issues that are kind of unique to the times? For example, do you get a lot of questions about Facebook and texting etiquette or recession-related money issues?
Yeah, absolutely. The questions that come into the column very much reflect the kind of decisions people actually have to make. And you touched on the biggest and most significant upsurge in questions for me have to do with all kinds of online media. Downloading music has been a persistent question since Facebook questions involve all sorts of privacy issues. I have access to my teenage child's Facebook page, but I know my child doesn't really know I'm looking at it, and she thinks it's private. You know, can I bust her for her drunken rowdiness, that kind of thing?
You can, and the answer is?
We adults realize that when you post something online and provide broad general access to it as a technical matter, you have published it. It's there for everyone, and you have no reasonable expectation of privacy. But that's not what children think, that kids regard Facebook as something akin to a diary. And even if your child leaves her diary on the kitchen table, she still, I think, reasonably expects that you will respect her privacy. From my perspective, unless you have probable cause is a nice idea. If you think your child is in danger, you have a duty as a parent to protect your child. And if there's no other way to find out if your child is in danger, as a last resort, you may start infringing on their privacy by looking at their Facebook page. So only with probable cause. And even then, I think you have another duty, which is to start to teach your kids about how to operate online, how to operate safely, and what expectations of privacy they can and can't have.
This is On Point. I'm Betsy Stark, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about moral dilemmas and everyday quandaries with the New York Times ethics columnist Randy Cohen. And Randy, since I raised the question, is it okay to call in with a personal question on the company's time?
Oh, I think it's almost required, isn't it? You're serving a greater public good by supporting public radio,
by engaging your
fellow citizens in this lively conversation. Yeah, oh, yes.
there's a resounding yes. Do you think that people, I'm sure you've gotten this question before, I'm very curious about the answer, do you think that people are basically moral and ethical at heart, or do they tend to be governed by their baser instincts? What's your view of the basic goodness of people?
I'm not sure what you mean by baser instincts. I think there's that our moral conduct, our moral reasoning is shaped by evolution. The evolutionary biologists have been weighing in here in ways that are really interesting and persuasive, that our sense of right and wrong itself is subject to evolution, and it might have functions concerning how well we can get along with one another in groups. So that's very interesting to see. But as we were saying before, that your initial moral response isn't necessarily something you should then act on. For instance, there's often an urge to just smack somebody, but we don't do that. We generally don't do that. We shouldn't do that in nearly every situation. So that what evolution has given us, what you might call human nature has given us, are a series of tendencies and feelings and initial responses that should just be the starting point for our reasoning.
Well, as we contemplated our hour with you today, the staff here at On Point put together what I'll call a quick-fire round of ethical questions for you. So I'm going to fire away, all right?
Okay.
First one, my friend's teenage daughter told me she's sexually active. Am I obligated to tell her mother, or do I keep the daughter's confidence?
If you promise the daughter's confidence, you have an obligation to respect that confidence. You can't simply lie to her. The harm you'll do will be ever so much greater. That this betrayal of trust is a serious thing and resonates through the whole community. Then no child will feel they can tell any adult anything, with this exception that if this child is in imminent serious danger of harm to herself or other people because of her activities, then you must intervene to help her. You have a duty to protect her. But simply being sexually active, it's not of itself mean she's in any particular danger.
Well, let me move on to the next one. This one is, I think my brother is doing a disservice to his kids by homeschooling them. Do I owe it to the kids to tell my brother that?
Well, you owe it to yourself to tell your brother that, and to do it courteously and respectfully and tactfully. That's part of being in a family. That it's interesting and to have discussions about just such things, as long as you do it in a way that won't insult your brother or treat your brother contemptuously. These are things honorable people can differ with. But I'm for the maximum amount of conversation, but that can only happen if you conduct it respectfully.
Here's one I think we're all going to want the answer to. What is the maximum number of free napkins I can take from a fast food restaurant before I am stealing?
7. Aristotle said that. It doesn't work. Ethics doesn't work that way, or at least the way I understand ethics doesn't work that way. That it actually involves you having some sense of other people. The way the fast food restaurant is set up, please use all the napkins you need, take all the little ketchup packets you need while you are there to enjoy your meal there. That it is a restaurant in a sense. I mean, you know, it's a fast food restaurant. It's a restaurant in the sense of providing, you know, dangerously salty and fatty food. So they're going to hell. We know that. But within that context, what it is not is a restaurant supply house. It is not a supermarket. It's not where you're supposed to be restocking your cupboards at home. If that's what you're doing, you're out of line.
Do you think, this kind of raises an interesting point, which is, you know, there's a hefty dose of common sense, it seems to me, in a lot of the ethical conclusions you reach.
Well, I hope so, because the opposite would be, boy, you look like an idiot. But I hope that so elegantly have I constructed my argument, so charmingly have I presented it, that when you get to the conclusion, it seems like common sense. But I'm not entirely persuaded you might have leaped to that conclusion all by yourself, or I'd be out of work.
This is the fourth from our staff here at On Point. A colleague asked me if I'm pregnant. I am, but I lied and said I wasn't because I was afraid it would hurt my career advancement. Is it okay that I lied?
What's really wrong here is the colleague had absolutely no business asking. That as a matter not just of ethics, but of federal law, the Pregnancy Anti-Discrimination Act, pregnancy may not be a factor in promotion or hiring. But we know the history of women in the workplace that it often is. And so your boss, certainly, or anyone in authority over you, absolutely should not ask that. It's none of their business. Having been asked, it's always better, even if asked an inappropriate question, it's always better if you can respond without actually lying. So if you can tactfully just divert the question to something else, like, look, is that a monkey over there? I use that if all else fails. You're better off. But what's really out of line is to even for a supervisor to raise this question.
And the final question from our On Point staff is, my grandmother has an old dog that is sick. It wears a sweater to stay warm and needs to be helped to the bathroom. I'm pretty sure the dog is suffering, but my grandma is very attached to it. Is it within my bounds to suggest she put the dog down?
Again, anything that a question that's raised, ought I to discuss it? May we talk about it? Yes, of course. Gently and respectfully, there's very little that ought not be talked about with out of benign motives to people you care about. Of course you should. But the harder question, what to do about the dog, is truly, truly difficult. I talked to Peter Singer about these kind of animal rights questions and questions that involve the moral standing of animals. And he was very persuasive that Singer argued that once an animal requires extraordinary medical intervention, you're quite often increasing the animal's suffering. And you're acting not for the benefit of the animal, but for yourself in this case, because the grandmother understandably loves her dog. But you really have to think, am I doing the dog harm by making extraordinary efforts to extend its life?
Well, that raises a very interesting question vis-a-vis the moral continuum for humans. If you feel strongly that that's what it is for people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. These are deeply challenging questions. I mean, Singer argues, and I think completely persuasively, that for the moral standing of animals, which isn't to say that a clam is the same as a person, that every creature does not have the same moral standing, Singer would say, and not every creature is worthy of the same consideration. That if, you know, it was Einstein and an oyster in a rowboat, and if you had to throw one overboard, I hope you would throw the oyster overboard. But which you ought not, one guideline becomes you ought not inflict harm on another creature that can experience harm.
Let's go to some of our listeners' questions for you, Randy. Marianne is calling from Foxborough, Massachusetts. Marianne, you're on point. What's your question for Randy Cohen?
Hi. I'm calling about an issue with divorced parents. And I wanted to talk about how it is for divorced parents to be working together with each other, trying to work out a way to be on the same page when there's been a lot of conflict and it was a very ugly situation when the parents divorced, and yet one parent might still be working in the background to try to perhaps get sole legal custody. Like, it feels a little bit awkward in terms of, oh, yes, we're working together to make our relationship better so that we can be good parents to these kids, and yet still trying to exclude the other person in terms of a kind of a longer-term goal.
Thanks, Marianne. So, Randy, if I understand the question correctly, is it ethical to speak to the child's father, work cooperatively on some things, while at the same time working to get legal custody of the children and the children's father's unaware of that?
When you put the question that abstractly and that generally, it's easy to answer. You go, well, sure, that people discuss and cooperate with one another even though all their goals are not identical. That's what happens once there are other people involved. In some ways, your interests are identical. In some ways, they conflict, and you try to courteously and with generosity of spirit work all that out. Well, as opposed to what? Slapping each other? But I think what your caller was getting at was a particular situation that involved particular kinds of behavior, and unless she describes those to us, it's hard to answer, to give more than that kind of general cheerful advice.
Let's go to Tom, who's calling from Lindenville, Vermont. Tom, welcome to On Point.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Your question for Randy.
Quick questions. First one is have you ever been stumped? Is there something that you can't answer or don't know how to answer? And my question is, my neighbor and I are pretty good friends, and he's painting his house this awful yellow, bright color. And he's asked me a couple times if I think I like it, you know, what my opinion is. And I'm like, yeah, sure, fine, but it is hideous. Should I tell him the truth? Because I got to stare at myself, or should I not?
Tom, thank you for your call. Randy, let's start with the issue of the ugly yellow paint color on the house next door.
If you're asked before the paint goes on, that's great. Then I just admire your neighbor for being so unbelievably considerate of the community, like understanding that his actions affect other people. Then when your neighbor says, oh, here's what I'm thinking of painting my house, what do you think? You can, again, tactfully and respectfully say, you know, yeah, that's a pretty intense color for this community. That's fine. If you're asked after the paint is already up, and no matter what you say, it's going to stay there for the next 5 years. How long do you? I live in an apartment myself. Then I think you're in a pickle. The guy isn't going to change his paint job because of anything you say. That I would be inclined to give a tactful answer. You know, you ought not lie, and you ought not encourage him to, you know, slap another coat of this yellow on when he repaints. You can say it's not my favorite color, but I can see why you like it. I mean, you can look for the tactful out.
And to Tom's other question, have you ever been stumped?
All the time. That the only questions I think worth taking up in the column are the ones that are really hard. If the answer is obvious, it'll just bore the reader silly. And when it's really obvious, I hope people don't send them in. So there's many a question that I sit on for a long time and continue to think about and talk to friends about. And if it involves some kind of expertise, if it's a question about medicine or law, as many of them are, I then consult with experts. But yeah, I'm frequently stumped. I can tell you the first one that really threw me. It was while traveling on business, I saw my best friend's spouse at the hotel bar in the arms of another. Should I tell my friend?
That's a classic.
It's a hard classic because you have two duties here, you know, and the most significant one, in my view, is the duty of friendship. What do you owe to your friend? And does your friend even want to know? There's so many uncertainties about the situation, and the possibility of doing real harm to another person's marriage is something that should be taken very seriously.
So how did you resolve that one? Or are you still mulling that one over?
No. But it took months of talking to various people about this one to come up with the right answer. I felt that your job in this situation is not to be the morality police. Whether or not you approve or disapprove of infidelity is kind of beside the point here. That your primary obligation is to your friend. That you should act in a way that serves the friend. And so the question then becomes is, would my friend want to know? And I think this is a question, especially judging by my reader response, people are very split on. Some people very much want to know. Some people will take great umbrage if this knowledge is forced on them. They might somehow in the back of their head have an inkling, and they've just sort of decided, well, I can go along with that. But if you rub my face in it, then I have to act. I must confront my spouse. So if you know your friend wants to know, you have to tell them, even though they're not going to be happy with you for that. If you know your friend doesn't want to know, you have to shut up, even though that means carrying around the burden of this secret. It gets tricky when you're not sure what your friend wants. Because then it's too late to say, hypothetically, you know, you can't do that then. My solution there was, well, it should be on your driver's license. Like on the New York State driver's license, it says, I want to be an organ donor. I don't want to be an organ donor. It should be that for infidelity. I want to know if my spouse is straying. I don't want to know. And when your friend's in the bathroom, go through their wallet.
Okay. Let's hear from Marianne calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Marianne, what's your question for Randy Cohen?
Hi, Randy. I admire your column. I love it. I have
Thank
a question.
You.
My son and his roommate were both teaching an SAT prep class, and they had were employed by this company. Summer came, and the friend was going off to Chicago to work with underprivileged children, low income, who obviously could not afford to have taken the class. And he was planning on coaching these students with to help them get with their SAT prep. So my son was adamant, saying that they had been entrusted with this knowledge and that it wasn't right for them to be doing this. Now, both of these boys are philosophy majors, and so it was involved endless discussion. And I could see both points of view, but I felt as if the fact that the friend was doing something that was better for the community rather than better for the, you know, the business. So what would you say? What would your stand be?
I would say that every job you have and every experience you have as you advance through life and as you advance professionally teaches you something. And no employer has the right to say, you must go have a surgical procedure that purges all experience and sophistication you've gained on this job so you never again use it on another job. We hope that each job teaches us and makes us better at what we do. And each new employer, this SAT prep, he reaped all the rewards of everything your son and his friend learned before they got there. So it's unrealistic and priggish to think that you can't apply your knowledge and experience elsewhere. What some companies can do under the law, and not unreasonably, is certain very particularly defined methods and practices can be trade secrets or can be proprietary knowledge with a company. So if they have highly refined methods of teaching that they and only they developed, then they might reasonably be hold on to those. And so the friend could certainly begin by asking permission. But short of those extreme cases, which I doubt that they apply here, the friend should teach freely.
This is On Point. I'm Betsy Stark, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about workplace conundrums and the ethics of everyday living with New York Times ethics columnist Randy Cohen. And Randy, why is it we all seem to love advice columns so much?
You know, My favorite thing about this column, and I think it's one of the things that the readers gravitate to, is each question is this little 75-word little mini-drama. And there's something at stake. Someone's in peril in some way. Someone's struggling with a decision. And like all good drama, the outcome is in doubt. We don't know what they're going to do, but they're going to have to take an action. I think people really like that. And the questions, of course, that get the biggest response are the questions that other people have had some kind of experience with. And I think they're often the kind of questions you've raised today. They're tough, and the answers aren't clear.
Let's turn just for a moment to political ethics and business ethics. We hear more about the failures than the successes. But do they strike you as too absent in business and political life?
It depends on your historical framework. That if you compared both to say the Gilded Age, America in 1890, we're wildly better behaved than we were then. You know, you get very little tainted meat these days. You know, you can get a job with working for your city government without having to bribe someone. You know, in order to get to work on a sanitation truck. In that sense, we're a much improved society. If you look over the shorter term, I'm less optimistic. Enron and Abu Ghraib come quickly to mind. And frankly, we've entered a zone where it's impossible to separate ethics and politics. And I mark this kind of dissent as a post-Reagan experience, that once it became a dominant political idea that that government has less of a function, that we should stop thinking of ourselves as members of communities, that the autonomous individual should just try to get everything he can, this sort of brutal free market approach, things descended. This notion that regulation no longer was seen as creating the conditions under which people could act honorably, but as somehow a barrier to acting at all, I think the results were not so great. And while I mark it from the rise of Reagan, I do not exempt Democratic administrations. It seemed to me there was no significant change when Bill Clinton was president, for example.
Well, let me ask you to weigh in on some of the questions du jour from the political and business worlds. And let me start with this, the issue surrounding Congresswoman Maxine Waters, who allegedly arranged for her husband to meet who has shares in a bank, to meet with someone about getting TARP money.
Right, yeah.
Unethical, if true?
Well, it remains to be seen, and much depends on what actually happened, what the actual facts of the case turn out to be. I'm reluctant to weigh in too quickly because we're still waiting for that hearing and for those facts to come out.
Google, Microsoft, Apple, Yahoo, dozens of other companies are tracking your personal information on the internet and selling it without you knowing it. Unethical?
Yes. That I will weigh in on. Absolutely. I'm very... I cast a very jaundiced eye on opt-out, that it seems to me there are certain rights to privacy that are worthy of respect. And before someone is going to violate those rights, you have to be involved in that discussion. And this is a case, much as we were talking about earlier, where a shift in technology has created a new set of ethical problems. Because these companies can do it, they are doing it. And our laws, our regulations, our protections for individuals are lagging behind this emerging technology. It'll be interesting to see what protections were granted.
Now, here's one that's in the news. Michelle Obama's luxurious vacation in Spain. Unethical?
Which is the part you object to, vacation, luxury, or Spain? Because I like Spain and I respect the Spanish people, Betsy. No, this is politics at its most contemptible to object to this. It seems to me Michelle Obama is doing nothing significantly different from any other first lady since, I don't know, Martha Washington. She's taking a vacation. Why is that bad?
Let's hear from another caller. Edward is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Edward, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a professor at a large research university, and so that means about 90% of my salary actually comes from grants to support my research, but 10% comes from the school, and that's what covers my teaching. And so what happened at the one semester, a few semesters ago, is that during the course of the semester, I worked really hard and intensively with all my students. But when it came to the final paper, I was so busy with my research that I didn't really have time to read all the students' papers. So what I was thinking of doing was just giving all the students A's on their final paper, because they actually, when it turns out, they actually don't come back to me to get pick up their final papers anyway.
Edward, thank you for your call. Randy, what do you think?
I think Edward knows the answer to this, and I think you do too. And I think the listeners do too. No, he can't. Of course, he can't ignore their final papers. That's meant to be an educational device. If it was going to serve no, and it may have served part of its function simply by having them write it, of course. But he is meant to respond to that, both as an evaluative tool to determine how well they did in the class and how much understanding they have of the material, but also how he comments on it is meant to advance their understanding of the subject. No, he can't simply forsake that. I'm sorry. Even if many kids don't come back for their papers, even if he's busy doing other things, that's part of his job.
Let's go to George, calling from Bellbuckle, Tennessee. George, welcome to On Point. Your question for Randy.
Yes. Hello, Betsy. Hello, Randy. I have a question that goes maybe a little deeper than just these individual ethical questions. It seems to me that a lot of what I'm hearing in terms of these ethical responses is just a matter of opinion, and perhaps I'm confusing ethics with morality. But if I look around at a religious person and I ask them what are their principles for their ethics or morality, they'll pull out a book that supposedly comes from God and give me that. But otherwise, it seems like the principles that people are using to come up with their ethics are just made up. And as a secular person, when I look around at nature, the ethics of nature seems to be simply survival of the strong. So my question to Randy is, how do you derive the principles that you base your ethics on, and why should I look to those as opposed to just any other system of ethics?
George, thank you for your question.
Yeah, and an entirely fair question and a very challenging one. I begin with this premise that I am entitled to no more respect or dignity or moral consideration than anybody else. That I begin with that egalitarian assumption that all people are entitled to that which I am entitled to as a matter of moral reasoning. And once you start with that, then there are all sorts of conclusions that flow from it very, very quickly. That ethics is then our effect on other people. And that leads you into the golden rule very quickly, as it has moral philosophers for 4,000 years. That leads you into, again, the categorical imperative if you approach it that way, or the tool of utilitarianism, you know, the greatest good for the greatest number. But that each of these positions and each of these devices can be defended logically. I can make a reasoned case. If you'll share that first assumption that I'm entitled to no more moral consideration than anyone else, that any other human being, I believe then my task is to persuade you reasonably that the action I prescribe is the best action. That's how I handle it.
Randy, here's a question a lot of homeowners are facing right now that has ethical implications, to be sure. Many are underwater on their mortgages. Their homes will never be worth what they paid for them. That's what they fear. And while they may even have the money to keep making mortgage payments, many are considering walking away from these houses rather than hold on to a bad investment and possibly drain their resources financially. Is it unethical to say, I'm not paying this anymore, I'm walking away from this mortgage, even though I may be able to pay for it?
It is not unethical, in my view, that if you're saying, need we protect these poor, weak, frail little banks from these, like, incredibly cunning poor people? Is that what the question is? Look, you have a contractual relationship.
It's arisen with a lot of affluent people, too.
Yeah, well, but I think in this power relationship between the lender and the borrower. It is the lender that is the bigger institution, is more sophisticated, has more power, and knew exactly what they were getting into. And the way they knew, it was written out in a contract. Everyone knew what their mutual obligations were. Banks routinely make decisions based on what's financially advantageous. That's what investing is, to make decisions based on your financial interests. So it seems to me that to ask the bank to fulfill only that obligation, how can you ask the borrower to go any further? That you have a duty to honor your contract, and the contract stipulates, oh, if you miss certain payments, here is what will happen. That's what you and you must live up to that, and you're bound by that. But must you go further? Must you make decisions that you feel are harmful to you and your family so that some bank can come out ahead? No.
Let's get a question from Tommy, calling from Washington, D.C. Tommy, welcome to On Point.
Hello. My question is, in college, we had this dining card. And at the university, you prepaid for the dining card. It wasn't subsidized by the university. They actually made money off of the dining program. Now, with that card, you got a swipe for each meal. And with each swipe entitled you to a certain number of items at one of the dining halls. So occasionally I wouldn't get all the items that I was entitled to. And over the course of the semester, I was probably behind on the number of items I should have gotten. But then on other occasions, if I wanted extra stuff, I would just go ahead and sneak extra stuff like cookies or extra drinks. Now, I had a friend that said that was wrong because it was stealing, because the sign at the dining hall actually said, you're definitely not allowed to do that. But I felt that I was entitled because by the end of the semester, I never even got the number of items that I was entitled to if I would have used each swipe to the maximum. How do you feel about this?
Randy, hungry college students everywhere want to know your answer to that.
I feel if you're using the verb sneak in your question, you probably know the answer. It may be an unfortunate meal plan, but it is the meal plan you're participating in, and if your treats are not transferable from one meal to the next, so be it. You're bound by those rules. That the reason the meal plan is priced the way it is they're assuming not everyone is going to take the maximum amount they can take in every meal. I can of course conceive a meal plan where you just get what you want every meal, and you would have to price it accordingly. But that's not the plan, unfortunately. You have, and yeah, you agree to it, you're kind of stuck by it.
Let's take another call. Greg is calling from Newport News, Virginia. Greg, welcome to On Point. Your question for Randy.
Thank you for taking my call, Randy. It's a family question relating to mother and father and children. The mother and father being somewhat elderly, and the mother, they live together, they're doing fine yet on their own. But the mother is showing signs that she could be having Alzheimer's. There's things going on, and everyone's noticing it. So the children, who are no longer children, they're actually grown adults, are recognizing that and want her to be tested. So they schedule tests. Well, every time the test comes up, the father, the dad, just conveniently cancels and will not talk to the kids about that. They go, why did you do that? Well, I don't want to talk about it. It's not necessary. She's not suffering anything. So the father will not let the mother actually be tested, and the kids are so frustrated and wondering just how would they properly address that.
Randy?
It's an incredibly poignant situation, because everyone is acting as they think best to help this person that they love. One piece of practical advice I've been given when I've consulted medical experts on this is sometimes you can do well if you can go outside the family circle and get a kind of mutually agreed on, respected person that the father is apt to listen to and that the kids are apt to listen to. It could, if it's a clergyman that everyone respects, if it's the mother's doctor that everyone respects, that's really great. So that's sometimes a way to get around that kind of family clash of entirely well-meaning people.
Randy, here's a question from our website, onpointradio.org, that I think a lot of people will relate to. Posted by Margaret, what about using sick days at work as personal, I need to get things done days?
Yeah, I reluctantly come down against it. It's a travesty that we have so few of each, that we have the worst vacation allotment of any advanced Western nation. We have the worst sick day schedule. We have the worst personal day schedule. Maternity leave, it's a ridiculous travesty. You know, I weep for us as an advanced nation. We're a little better than apes, and I'm deeply ashamed every time I see someone from Spain or France or Italy, or let alone Scandinavia. But that said, a sick day is not a personal day, and that's the set of rules you're stuck with at the office. And to make a personal day, to take a personal day when you're not sick and call it a sick day involves lying to other people, and I'm very reluctant to engage in that kind of lying.
Randy, I wonder, can you ever get away from what you do?
Oh, it's terrible. You know, when I go to a party, people do indeed buttonhole me and ask for moral advice. And all the only question I really have is, you know, where's the bar? And I never knew how to handle this because, you know, there is no off-duty sign. And there's this feeling that there was incredible debauchery going on. And then I arrived, the professional wet blanket. It's awful. But a friend who is a doctor who gets this much more than I do has always asked medical advice when she's trying to go have a good time at a party. She gave me two sentences, and I now use them, and I give them to your listeners. Here's the takeaway, because this works for any job. If someone asks you your professional opinion in a personal setting, you just say, what my friend says, well, take off your clothes and hop up on the table, and I'll sort you right out.
All right, well, our thanks to Randy Cohen, who writes the Ethicist column for the New York Times. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Betsy Stark, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.